Blog Talk Radio. Storybox Audio.
You know, I'm going to have to get a hold of my little buddy Michael Cooper, ask him to make us a tiny intro. We shouldn't be advertising Storybox intros. Welcome,
okay.
Everybody, to the Sunday show on Herpy Nonsters Radio. And it is June 6th of 2021, a time when I guess a majority of America, I don't see this going on too much in other countries, but in America, it's the PR motion is out there that, you know, we are back at work, we are back in restaurants, we're back in theaters, and COVID is becoming a memory of the past. Well, okay.
That's what happens when you have good leadership.
Well,
yes.
I don't think it's actually becoming a memory of the past, but I hear what you're mm-hmm. saying, and that's fine and dandy. It's also the anniversary of several things, as you gentlemen were discussing before we came on air. Least of all,
yes.
you were really kind of freaking me out that people don't know what the significance of D-Day is. I'm like, wow, either I'm really fucking ancient or, you know, mm-hmm. it's just...
Well, young people don't know what it is. Older people, I would hope would, but not people that are the college age or high school age. They don't get taught history. And, of course, now the way it's going, they don't even want you to know about the Tulsa Race Massacre. They don't want you to know about what happened in Florida and Rosewood in 1923. They don't want you to know about the mass murder of Native Americans because that's not making people feel good. This is the kind of
yeah.
craziness we have in the Republican Party, and they don't want to teach science either. Science and history
yeah.
are under attack, and that's horrifying.
Yeah,
that's
bad. That's
very
bad.
I'll draw a little parallel here. It just popped in my head because I had this discussion the other day, but talking about not teaching science, you know, the history and the science. At one time, you know, we call it Arabic numbers. Algebra is based on the name Arab. Numbers, right?
That's supposed to say that.
Right. Well, then in like 600 A.D., I think it was that time frame, basically the uber-religious of the Muslims aspect found science to be anti-Allah and anti-Allah.
God,
right?
Monotheism,
and,
yeah.
Thank you. And basically stifled the scientific and the mathematical advancements of the Arab culture world.
Well, the same thing happened in the Roman Catholic.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
In Western culture, you know, the Roman Catholic Church, the Vatican, held sway over Western culture for how long?
Yes.
When the Romans gave up their pagan deities and said, okay, we'll go with the Christians because, you know, they seem to be winning
the
population.
Like the 1475 time frame-ish, the Renaissance, where there was like, Copernicus was a little before, but you got Galileo Galilei.
Yep.
There was a...
Yep. But even they paid a price.
Yes,
they paid
a
price with the church, with the Kirk, you
yeah.
know.
They were going to kill him. Let me tell you
something, buddy. You go against the Kirk in Ireland, in Southern Ireland, and if the priest bans you from the church, you can't get a drink at the local public house.
Oh, no, wait a minute. That's just going too far.
It was. I was on it.
Yes,
can I just intervene to say you have not introduced yourself or us, Gwen. So if people seeing don't know who we are, we know, but you have not mentioned even your own name.
Well, you know, thank you for joining me today, gentlemen. I have Wayne Johnson with me in Maryland and Ronald Feynman in Boca Raton. And this is the Sunday show.
Who are you?
And
I'm
we have the most gracious,
your name.
But
those who don't know you,
Holden, as the host
I'm
of the show.
I'm just the producer, and occasionally I let loose. That's about it.
She's the juggler that keeps all these balls in the air. Let's go let her get you.
But it is stunning that young people are not being taught. I was stunned to hear years ago that civics had been pulled out of school. You know, they're not pulled out of certain schools. Let's be honest about that at least. I mean, there are schools where history and civics and higher forms of mathematical processing and all of that are actually taught, but there are schools that are for, I guess you would call, those who can afford it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, also when you think about it, I know there are a lot of people who would say, why do we have foreign languages in high school? We're English, you know, we speak English. We don't need to know any other language. I'm sure there's lots of that feeling, too.
That sounds very Republican. But root we learn these languages because they're root languages. English
yes,
is
exactly.
not a root language.
Yeah, I have a cousin now in his 80s, and he became a Russian language professor. And the thing is that
Whoa.
When he was going to college and graduate school in the 50s and 60s, the thought was, why are you studying and want to teach Russian? Why, are you a communist? This is the kind of crazy stuff. Well, the Russians knew English, but we didn't know Russian.
Well, English is the business language of the planet right now, but many people have been thinking for the last 20 years that it's going to shift over into Mandarin. So there's that.
Why
a lot of young people are studying, a lot of young people have chosen to study for the last, like, 20 years, the Eastern languages, the Far Eastern languages. We're the romantic language. We're the romance language.
Wayne, you were talking about your family and D-Day and other things. I think you should share it with the audience.
Well, okay, personal family members. My great-grandfather, who actually raised my mother and her cousin, came over from Germany at the turn of the century, was in World War I, and was joined the army. And, of course, he spoke German, but they had him in the Philippines at the time. But his son, which would be the twin of my grandmother, was in the 101st Airborne and parachuted behind enemy lines on D-Day. And then also Dad's youngest brother landed at Normandy, drove in, you know, fought into France and stuff, and then they put him in a little quiet area so that these guys could decompress, which was the Ardennes Forest. He is one of seven that survived the Battle of the Bulge.
Wow. That man
has seen some real battles and stuff. He just passed away here recently at the age of 85. So.
Wow.
Okay, so,
my dad did not make the D-Day. He was waiting in England. He was part of Patton's army.
Jeez.
And they went in afterwards and shot up into Italy and through Italy into Germany.
Yeah, he was a tank commander.
Yeah.
Yeah. Winston Churchill's the underbelly of the attack coming up from the southern aspect. Plus, too, I just spoke with or texted a classmate of mine. His dad, which was also my history teacher. My father was a school teacher, and so was his dad, so we had that kind of commonality. But his dad was with the Rangers, you know, the Army unit called the Rangers, and was the one that climbed the cliffs there, and landing at the Normandy, right, and survived that. So,
amazing.
That's quite a feat. The most realistic, there are two movies I can think of that were realistic enough to give you, you know, just put your heart in your throat. One of them was Saving Private Ryan, the beach landing in that was incredible. And then there was another movie made with Brad Pitt called Fury, which taught me a lot about what my father went through as a tank commander. I had no idea. But people forget, too, that World War II saw the most gore and casualty of any war on the planet.
That's right.
Even more so than World War One, the trench warfare of World War One,
which was horrifying too. And
yeah,
it did. There was like 60 million perished through the whole thing.
Wow.
And
there's another movie called The Longest Day.
That's
a
good movie. But it does not really portray. It's more of a sit back and just scenic view.
Yeah, I agree with you, Gwen. Yes, that the scene there, the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan, when they were coming onto the beaches of Normandy, what that was really, that's, matter of fact, there were vets who saw that and said, yeah, it's about as close as I've ever seen that portrayed.
Yeah, I remember seeing Saving Private Ryan and being very tense sitting there, more tense than I've ever been in a movie, you know?
I cried. Right? I cried. Just absolutely cried. And I'll tell you what, war and all of the violence and everything of war, when it's portrayed the way it has been taken up by a few filmmakers in the last, 30 years, it should put that presence of no more war into the consciousnesses of people. But it
has not done that.
It hasn't fully done that.
Yeah.
And we forget too easy.
Don't have our children being taught enough. That's the problem, because it might make them feel bad, in quotes, so we don't teach about it. This is what's going on in education now.
Well,
oh, that's crap.
Let's take a current event where we were taught, and really because it was meant to be the lessons, so we would not repeat them, of how fascism permeated through Italy, Germany, Spain, and things like this. That let's not make that mistake again. And what do? They're supposed to be the ultra-conservatives, right? We're the party of God and Jesus, to vote for a Republican as Jesus. Embrace the most fanatical, reactionary, Proud Boys, neo-Nazis, the Klansmen and stuff. And
white supremacists, yep.
Yeah, the white supremacists, which is exactly what we were supposed to be learning the lesson of not to do.
Well, it's also basically white supremacy at the bottom bone of it. But, Nazism in Germany and the way that they sort of cobbled it together over there, they got a lot of it from America. You know that, gentlemen.
Oh, yeah. Well,
yes. And imagine those post veterans that came home, the black veterans, and then they were massacred in 1921 because they didn't, they were not given any respect for their contributions to the First World War.
The matter of fact, when they were interviewing and talking with the former Nazi leaders at the time, shortly after the war, and asked them, how did they get this way and this stuff, and they said, "Hey, so we just took your Jim Crow laws and applied them in our country."
And we have people still promoting that
the
now.
The Nazi legal system was based on the United States' the Jim Crow laws.
Yes.
True statement.
It keeps changing up with humanity because we can trace these kinds of social structures way back to when we began to resource and go to war. And creating the other. And
He became a friend, but he was a customer of mine. He was on Nixon's staff in charge of all the radio and television communications the first 4 years. He left because he and Kissinger didn't get along. It was Marshall Shahoyan. His mother was one of the Armenians that the Ottoman Turks gathered up everybody in the Armenian communities and started death marching them all over, which was the Ottoman Empire, which was Syria, Lebanon, and a little bit of Iraq and stuff.
At least one thing, Joe Biden did recognize that this year after all the years that no president's been willing to acknowledge that.
Exactly.
Armenian massacre,
and,
15, yeah.
The story, one of the stories, his Marshall's sister wrote a book basically describing her mother's aspect. Marshall's mother was like 5 years old, and she was basically taking care of her three-year-old sister on this death march, because the parents had already been, the fathers and the grandfathers had already been basically exterminated, shot at the firing squad and stuff like that for simply just being Armenian. And one night, you know, when they were bedding down and stuff, the three-year-old sister, baby sister, laid her lap in the five-year-old's, in her five-year-old's lap. And basically when the five-year-old woke up in the morning, the three-year-old baby sister had died on her lap, with her head in her lap left that night. That's the kind of atrocities that man can commit to other men.
God. And that, and also women, not only men. The women are also involved in these attacks, like Nazi camp guards that were women as well as men. Yeah.
And people really don't give much credence to the fact that how many women made it successful for, you know, that for World War II to be won. I mean, my mom was in the Navy in the Office of Strategic Services in Washington. But, I mean, how many women from America joined the services and went over? Of course, they called them wax waves and bams at the time. But and in England, how many women? And then in the resistance in many of these countries, the resistance was made up, the White Rose Society, all of them were made up and founded by many women.
Yes.
So
that's the good side, but the bad side, again, was Nazi women. That, you know, there's really more about that, too. So it's like with anything, men or women, that there's good and there's evil around us.
Oh, well, that's quite true. Yes, it is.
Yeah, evil isn't gender selective.
No, it was not. But then not only does today and this week bring up that, but we were speaking about how it brought up the Reagan years and AIDS.
Yes, the anniversary of the first cases of HIV, 40 years, and Reagan did not deal with it until after Ryan White, a hemophiliac child, died of it. Then he finally started to recognize it. But he also had cabinet meetings. They made fun about San Francisco, about the so-called gay disease, San Francisco, and they were laughing at one cabinet meeting. I've read that. Can you believe it is the early 80s? That's disgraceful.
Oh, go ahead, Glenn. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, if you take a look at the portrayals and the books that have been written in the succeeding years about these people and how they behaved on the, you know, in the behind the privacy of no cameras or lenses and, you know, with themselves, these are not people I would have made friends with, would you?
No.
I would not have had a friendship with these people. Now, when you're a politician, you make, quote, make friends with several different people because that's part of how you get things done. But my mom used to have a saying, and she was quite right about it, but when I heard her say these are not nice people, I knew what she meant. She meant they were people like that deserve to be strung up like a Mussolini or bombed out like a Hitler, you know?
Yeah,
not nice people. And it seems as though we have a leadership glut right now of not nice people.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yes. They're very few and far between. And Reagan has been so glorified. You know, of course, he came across publicly as pleasant compared to Trump. But behind the scenes, he was very biased, bigoted, narrow-minded in so many ways, intolerant. But he made a good presentation in public, you know.
Yeah, he was around. Yeah. He delivered lines.
Yeah.
Well, that was quite true. I've read a few books and stuff. I don't think he was complete. I don't think he was completely cognizant or conscious of all of what was going on around him. And I'm not saying that because he finally showed up with the Alzheimer's. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just thinking that he was always more or less in a lot of actors have said the same thing of the era, and he was more or less sort of a dupe. You know, he wasn't one of the brightest bulbs in the pack.
Oh, he was not Jimmy Carter's brilliance, for instance. Jimmy Carter has one of the highest IQ. I think may have had the highest IQ of any president.
It doesn't have so much to do with his intelligence level as it does his common horse sense kind of awareness. You know, you walk into a room and you meet new people, and you kind of have a very good idea upon first meeting called
first
impressions.
First impressions matter.
And, you know, what kind of people that you are dealing with. Now, I have experienced in my life where my first impression was completely wrong, but not often, not often at all. And then
I've almost always first impression of anybody in any circumstance, I will get a feeling, and over time, 98% of the time, I'm correct, and so are you.
It is like that, but now a guy like Ronald Reagan is easily led, and yet he has this great ability to do boom out charisma. I mean, even his son says that, you know, and I happen to like Ron Reagan, the son.
Mm-hmm. As a person, yes.
Right.
Yeah, he's smart too. Policy.
I found him charming as a.
Yeah, he is.
And yeah, he was charming.
He said his father was charming too, but his father was charming in a way of not knowing any better. You know, he would have been charming to the devil as well as Saint Michael. You know.
Well, one thing about Reagan is that he had been a Democrat, a New Deal Democrat, and then when he met Nancy and married her and her father was a surgeon and Republican, he switched sides. And I think he knew what he was doing. He figured that was the way to probably move ahead. You know?
Yeah, that's what I think you're right.
That's survival gut instinct that comes alive when, you know, in certain circumstances, and everybody has those.
Yeah.
It's when we choose differently. You know, choosing differently from that gut, you know, I got to do this to survive. When you're willing to sacrifice, that's what raises you above the moral fiber of the rest of the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's leadership. The willingness to sacrifice, the willingness to give, you know, in honor and honesty, and not to be protectively putting a shell around you.
Yes.
Right. That's exactly right. So, I mean, Jimmy Carter, after, you know, the one term he served as president, accomplished some very great things. Matter of fact, I just watched a movie about Nasser passing away, Anwar Sadat moving up as the president of Egypt, and they were making war plans along with Syria and I think Jordan to all of a sudden go in. This would have been 74, 72, the second war like that. Of course, that's when...
73, actually, the second Middle East war, yeah. 73,
yeah.
October.
Was it 73? Wow.
October 73, yeah. And then after that war, Sadat switched from the Russians to the United States.
Exactly. Well, they talked about after that. If they went in there, they would lose the Russian support and the money, because really it was the Russian money that was propping up the Egyptian economy at that time, much like Cuba, right? Cuba would not survive if Russia wasn't funneling money into it.
Well, yes. That's true.
But anyway, it was just a very good story along that lines. And then this is where Jimmy Carter took these two most polarized views of these men, of Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin, took him to Camp David, which is Thurmont, Maryland. I've actually done consulting work in the town of Thurmont. And basically got him talking, you know.
13 days of David. In May, 13 days, it's, you know, 13 days of Camp David, yep.
Yep. So, and that's
actually, it's an interesting thing. I just realized recently there's two 13-day situations. The first 13 days, the Cuban Missile Crisis in '62 was 13 days, and then the agreement between Egypt and Israel at Camp David was also 13 days. Just an interesting comparison. That same number of days, both historic moments.
Professor, that's why I do so dearly love having you as a friend. You are so well-knowledged on these subjects and stuff and can input things like that. 13, that's the magic number now.
Yes, I want to put in something personal, which I usually don't do. Today is 49 years since I started to teach at the college level. I started on a Monday, June 6th, 1972, at Queens College in Flushing, New York. Walked into the class, introduced myself, and said, "Today's the 28th anniversary of D-Day." Everybody knew what D-Day is, and as you and I were talking along with Gwen, today, if you said today's D-Day, I think a lot of people, not older people, but younger people would say, "What's that?" So yeah. it's really a changed situation. But 49 years I've been in the classroom. I can't believe it. And yet I'm only 39.
You sound like my mother.
No, Japanese age, which dates me a bit.
You are truly a gift to academia, and that's what, you know, I'm going to give you those honors and those homages. So you're very, very
And today also is the day Robert Kennedy died in 1968 from assassination, which I wrote about a chapter of my assassinations threats in the American Presidency book. It's now 53 years, and as I wrote on the blog, I guess it was yesterday, I said that I think we don't know for sure that he would have been the nominee. We don't know for sure that he would have beaten Nixon, but I have a feeling he would have, and the history would have been very different. Not that he's perfect or would have been, but I think it would have been a different history in the 70s if he had been president, and it's really a sad moment.
Very good. Let me ask you this, Professor, because I obviously remember that very well of Sirhan shooting RFK there in that the kitchen.
He's still in prison, by the way.
Yeah.
Oh, was he?
He's still in prison,
What was Sirhan's motivation to assassinate?
It was about the Middle East War of 67. You know, he was a Palestinian Christian, by the way, not a Muslim. He is not a Muslim. He's a Christian. They are Palestinian Christians. But he was upset about the Six-Day War, where, of course, Israel gained territory from Egypt, Egypt and Jordan and Syria. And the fact that Robert Kennedy had backed Israel a year earlier to the day, because June 5th, 67, which is yesterday, June 5th was the beginning of the Six-Day War, and it was on June 5th, right after midnight in L.A., that he was shot. So it's exactly a year later, but he died on June 5th.
Like I said, I remember the incident well, but never knew what his motivation was, what triggered it.
Years later, he claimed that he didn't even know what he had done. So I think it was a mental case, too. But at the time, he did claim, it was said that he was angry and had told others about what had happened, the fact of that Israel had gone to war and had gained territory. So that's where we could say the beginning of Middle East terrorism affecting the U.S. started there when Kennedy was killed by him.
Well, and I'll have to make one. I mean, I understand your statement there, and maybe, but the correction I would make is Israel didn't go to war; they were attacked.
I'm saying that they were engaged in war. No, it's true; they were attacked. I'm saying the war took place. Israel gained territory from it, and that's why he was bitter about it. You're right. I didn't mean to say that it wasn't self-defense, but I'm just saying that you know that it did lead to that.
Yeah, the Golden Heights, which, of course, belonged to Syria, which was the high ground and could look down and they could lob shells in to Israel from that. Well, when they gained that high ground, you know, Israel said, I am never giving this back because you're never going to put me in that advantage situation again. And then, of course, Egypt had the Gaza Strip, if I'm correct me if I'm wrong, which they took over. And that's like, you know, that's another buffer that they have. And, of course, that's where the issues today of rocket launches coming from the Gaza Strip, and then the Israeli armies have to go in because Hamas has been in there, and they would build the rockets and then launch them in, so they had to try to take out the leadership.
Yes.
But, of course, then when I make that statement, the first thing that pops into my mind is Charles de Gaulle's famous quote, the graveyards are full of irreplaceable men. So even though the Israelis are taking out the leadership of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, there's plenty of others who will step up and redo it all over again.
Unfortunately, that's why it's a never-ending crisis there. You're right.
Exactly. So, now, what did I know Jordan lost some land in that territory in that aspect. You know, what area of Israel is that?
So I'm trying to think of exactly what the area is called.
Not the Dead Sea area?
Well, I guess control of East Jerusalem, that's what it is. They lost control East Jerusalem, so Israel controls all of Jerusalem. It did not between 48 and 67, East Jerusalem.
There you go.
Yeah.
See, folks, this is an educational program. We're not just liberals. We educate people. We are the intelligentsia, as W. Bush would say.
Well, you know something? Actually, I've just thought about it. Each week, and not every week is like June 6th, but you think about it, each week we can certainly look up what's famous on this weekend, and we can talk about the events in the past that happened on June 13th, June 20th. You certainly could do that. It could be a
very
fun
good.
Thing to do week
it's
by week, you know?
Like Harvey, what was it? Now you know the rest of the story. Oh, Harvey, what the hell is Harvey's name? Paul Harvey.
Oh, Paul Harvey. Oh, boy. What a voice he had, yes.
Oh, yeah, so.
You guys got me there.
Winger, do you know he was a real right winger?
Yeah, I did know that.
Oh,
yeah.
Was he right wing? He probably would make Rush Limbaugh blush.
Well, that's what he was. He was kind of a kinder Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah. But he had a dynamic voice, Paul Harvey. Oh,
yeah,
boy, you know.
Good. Yeah.
And then he would say, good day, or something at the end.
Right.
Remember the way he said that, yeah?
Yeah.
We're dating ourselves here, aren't we?
We've got to get Gwen back in the conversation here.
Yes.
You guys have lost me with your Paul Harvey commentary bullshit, but it's like bringing up William F. Buckley.
I'd rather eat,
as Stephen King says, you know, I'd rather eat dog turds on toast, but it's what are the comparative moments here to the moment we're in right now? We have a crisis in our policing community. We have a crisis with our neighborhoods and communities where people, especially of color, they haven't been accepted completely. They have not been treated well, and treated well. Jesus, what an understatement that is. They have been oppressed, and they have been driven and murdered, and we have this opportunity. And I want you guys to tell me the great things that the BNC machine that's in charge now is doing for it. And furthermore, why don't you tell me all about why these pussies are not pushing those Republicans right over the cliff and saying, screw you, we're going to push our bills through. Tell me, why?
Well, I must be honest, it's because of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. They're not cooperating, and without it, there are no 50 votes where Kamala Harris can break the tie. And now I see he's not willing, to, at least in the case of Manchin, to vote for the Voting Rights Act, and that's upsetting. You know, he insists there has to be bipartisanship. So I guess the effort has to be made, but I don't know if it'll work, of getting either Romney or maybe Alaska Senator Murkowski or Collins, even though I don't like him particularly, or somebody like that, to make it so-called bipartisan. But really, to me, it's silly because it's one vote. Even if you get one vote, that makes it bipartisan? I guess it does. But unfortunately, Joe Manchin senses that his state is a Republican state, he's a Democrat, and that if he goes too far, he'll lose his seat, and then it'll be even more Republican. So it's a mess. There's no easy way to get around this right now.
Joe Manchin is nothing but a soft Republican sitting in a Democrat seat.
Yeah, but
he's still a Democrat. For purposes of organization, if he would left the party, then the Republicans would control the Senate.
They're controlling it right now. Did you miss that? Did you guys miss that? They're controlling it.
Controlling
right
in the sense of
now.
Organization. I mean, because what
organization? Excuse me. Show me the organization where it's getting things done, please. I'm willing to look if you would just show me, please. I don't mean to sound like the.
I am
mad if I think about it, and I don't think about it anymore that much because you know why? It just drives me nuts.
Well, it upsets me too, but it's just the way things are right now.
You don't vote for old men. You don't vote for old people who can't change their minds and think that the old system is going to do any better than it has done for us in the last 30 years. You need people like AOC. You need people like an older woman, like Elizabeth Warren.
They have to be elected. That's the first thing. And now the Republicans are making it harder for that, too.
Because the DNC machine is outdated and corrupt and absolutely useless. It's useless. These guys are running roughshod, and until the great catastrophe happens, which is a coming somewhere, somehow, Everybody thinks COVID's over. Okay. How do you think the economy's going to do in the next year, huh, with real estate going back the way it was?
Matter of fact, I have a little shade on that. I was talking with my son-in-law, who's a mortgage broker, just today, because I wanted his input on it, because I'm looking at my retirement funds and things like that. And
sure.
As you know, the inflation rate is really climbing pretty quick. To give you an example, I have a nephew who's in contractor sales, lumber yard and stuff. And this was, of course, during this past summer of Trump. In the beginning of this time frame, last year, the materials to build a house, a modest three-bedroom rancher and stuff, was $40,000. But 3 months later, it was up to $80,000. In other words, it had a 100% increase. He's on the Eastern Shore, and this is the lumber prices. And the materials, you know, like you need the sink, you need the tub, and things like that, increased in that three-month time period of last summer of Trump here, 100% increase in the inflation of construction materials.
Well,
a lot of things are going up crazy pricing. It's ridiculous. Not just lumber.
Yeah.
It's just nuts.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I said the tubs and everything. Oh, yeah, you can see the price increases in grocery stores and things like that. I said something to my son-in-law today, and he said, another reason, too, is there hasn't been that much new construction. So henceforth, the demand is outpacing the amount of real estate available. I saw a program. My wife and I watched it. It was on the news. There's a lot of people, you know, from the being able to live someplace else, work from home, working remotely for large companies. Take, for instance, you should say you're making the New York City salary, but now you're going to move out into the Adirondacks because you can work wirelessly and virtual office space with Microsoft Teams. It's like a Skype, but it's very, very user-friendly and very coordinated. So I know myself working from home, between the cell phone, email, and this Teams software, they have better communication flows than if I was sitting in the office.
Right.
But that being said, they're taking that New York City salary and moving up into the Adirondacks. And, I'll give you this. Actually, they were talking about Montana, but that was just a scenario there. Homes in Montana are so few and far between that if a home goes up for sale, the starting price is just, here's where we start the bidding. And they're making jumps of $100,000 increments. That homes now in Montana are now going for $1 million.
The further away from urban areas, the more expensive the land has gotten, where it was sort of the reverse. Now it is the thing. You know, the country is now where people want to be because they're learning the lesson. Well, people who can afford it.
Right.
So it's going to leave the urban areas for grab and rentals because of COVID could not shoot up so much, but I'm scared they're going to think they can at the end of this summer. And I don't know, you know, it's like, it's frightening to think of the cost rises of, and especially real estate and what it did to us before and what it's doing to us now, where it's a nucleus of bad energy that's just building and building, and it's going to economically tumble again.
Yes, well, that's exactly right.
And it's not just America. Any other industrialized country, it's happening there too.
Yeah.
You know, because people are feared of, they're feared of disease now and what can happen.
Exactly. Here's the other thing too. Now, here's, we're talking about the demand in new construction. and this is for Pepco, which is the Washington, D.C. area. There is a new development being proposed. I'm actually doing a one-line diagram. That's like your beginning concept of the infrastructure grid. It's a family, a neighborhood, a family housing neighborhood of 192 homes. Each and every one of those homes will have solar panels on the roof. They will have battery backups to store the unused extra produced energy that so
right.
they can draw upon it later on and stuff.
Whole communities are popping up.
Yeah, it's also going to incorporate a PEM fuel cell. That's PEM, which stands for proton exchange membrane. This is where you use the hydrogen. In this case, they're going to use the hydrogen from natural gas, basically wick off the carbon, because it's a hydrocarbon fuel, and use that heart to generate electricity, too, to complement supporting the green energy aspect. And like I said, I'm doing the one-line diagram of that right now as we speak. And if this thing comes to fruition, then what we're designing here right now will become basically the standard for Pepco. I'm not doing the solar energy. I'm not doing the fuel cell and stuff. All I'm doing is what we're working on is once they have that there, integrating into the regular electrical infrastructure grid. That's kind of where my part flies in. So in other words, any new development will basically be based and designed with these aspects to the housing development, which will then constantly be feeding green energy to the electrical infrastructure grid to be continued used. That's what I do for a living, folks. That's what I do for a living.
You're brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
You know?
Oh, I listen to this and my mouth is open.
You know, matter of fact, I said for the listeners out there, I said to Glenn and the Professor Ron here, the brilliance of Nikola Tesla and the advances that he made, and basically didn't get financially rewarded because his motivation was he just wanted to make a better world for everybody. And that's kind of where the reward I get, you know, when I'm doing this kind of design and this kind of work. Is I just want to make a better world for everybody and the future generations like my grandchildren.
That's what it's all about.
That's,
yeah,
that's
can I intervene here? You had mentioned that your grandfather was a twin, I think you said?
No, he would be my great-uncle. My grandmother was a twin. As a matter of fact, her name was Grady and Gretchen, which is German for Hansel and Gretel.
Okay, so I'm thinking, so there's a twin in that background of your family.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Oh,
that
yeah.
explains
there's
why you have twin grandsons,
sides.
I guess, does it? It's genetics.
Yeah, there's twins on both sides of the family of my parents and my mother's side. Yeah.
Said that, it made me think, oh, that explains.
So there you go, yeah, yeah. And their granddad loves them dearly. They're going to be a handful in the teenage years. Right now at 4 years old.
They're identical, aren't they?
No, they're actually not. They're two separate eggs.
Oh, so fraternal. Okay, because they look very much alike from the pictures you've sent.
Well, they do. Yeah, they do. But, that's I can tell the difference to them and stuff. And the thing is they may be twins, but they are two separate personalities. Jay, he just takes an interest in music. He likes to listen to music and... Even when he was teeny tiny and he'd hear music, he'd like start body dancing and stuff. Oh, yeah, we're jamming, right?
Oh.
And I bought him a toy piano. And, granddad is teaching him, okay, here's like the Ray Me faucet, right? And then he'd play the other one and you get harmonic notes and stuff. Jay's the one who wants to sit down and zero in on that and replicate what granddad's doing. Mason's like, okay, it's fine, it's a toy, but he doesn't have the same driving interest that Jay does.
Well, everybody's an individual. It's fun to watch them.
Absolutely.
Just,
absolutely.
Yeah.
But their baby sister's going to rule the world, I'm going to tell you that right now.
What's her name?
Her name is Penelope, but we call her Pip.
Oh, okay.
And she and her granddad are buddies, boy. Yes, indeed, ever since she was teeny tiny. She wanted to be with Granddad. you know, she'd crawl over and crawl up in my lap, and there wasn't any debate on this. Is I'm sitting in your lap, right?
That's wonderful.
Of course, I just melted into a puddle. You know?
How much younger is she than them?
2 years. They're 2 years apart.
2 years, okay. Yeah.
The boys are 4 years.
That's
one.
Two. Yep. So. They're what, 4?
Yeah, the boys are 4. Yeah, the boys were four. They were March, I think they were March the 10th, and she's February the 1st.
So a little less than she is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
23 months, yeah.
There you go.
Great. It's wonderful.
But that's the point. That's in that film. Well, now, so I was going to say, good thing this isn't a televised show, because here, let me show you my grandchildren.
I would love to see them on video, actually.
Yeah, well, that's right. I do send you pictures and little video clips and stuff, but yeah, I care.
Yeah.
So anyway, what else did we talk about? We wanted to kind of bring into this conversation with the historical aspects of June the 6th. You know, so, but,
well, I'll just go back to the issue
to...
about HIV. I remember those times, and I know where I lived in New York at the time. That, and I used to be out with my oldest son, you know, sometimes, you know, in the playground in the back. You know, I was one of the rare men. It was mostly, you know, the mothers. And some of the mothers at times would be talking about the whole AIDS crisis. And I remember sitting there, and of course, now I wanted to be rude, but in my head, I was shaking my head. I cannot believe this, you know, what I'm hearing them saying, you know, the prejudice, the bias, the lack of concern. And that was in like mid-80s. And I didn't say anything because I didn't want to start a fight because these are neighbors. But I said, oh, my God, what's going on? I said, these parents, they're doing such horrible things by the things they – because they probably spread it to their own kids, you know. It really upset me, I remember the time.
Yeah, it was a pretty awful time. There was a lot of isolation and fear. I know that my sister's best friend, her brother, her twin brother, got it pretty badly. Mm-hmm. And Debbie and her friend were the only ones who would actually. He came from a very wealthy family, and they bought him a condo and put him in there with a nurse and said, "Stay away from me." You know, it was terrible. Just Debbie and her friend would go and spend the time, and, you know, anybody who wasn't afraid to be near them. I had friends in New York who caught it and were catching. I was not afraid to touch them. I was not afraid to be comforting. I was...
Because you're a good person, that's why. But a lot of people are not.
I was a little scared, too, but it wasn't enough to scare me away from kindness, you know? And to see anybody who was so scared and didn't know what was happening to them, people don't realize that for a long time. Men did not know what was happening to them. They didn't understand. Right.
If I touch their sweat, will I get it? You know,
right. There was a
lot of saliva, you know, things like that.
Well, I was sitting in a sit-in in New York, and with ACT UP, and I can remember a mounted cop spitting on me because I was protesting against, you know, nobody doing anything for these men.
Mm-hmm.
And then my fury grabbed me, and if I hadn't had a good friend sitting next to me who kept me sitting down, because I was going to get up and just slam him, you know. but we all ended up getting carted off anyways. And arrested and released, but it was a really scary, terrible time, and the heartache was incredible. You know, it was really incredible, and how long it took the gay community to learn what was going on and how they could protect themselves—that was tragic too. And I blame the government. I blame the leadership, of course. But they just sat back.
Yeah, they're not too... Then and now, there are not many people who have any sense of kindness in government. Few, but not many.
There used to be, though. I mean, there used to be, even when Nixon was in. You know, there used to be.
I understand what you're saying. But actually, even for people who I always have admired, it's about presidents. I look at Franklin D. Roosevelt, who certainly had his faults as well as his strengths. But I think of all the lynchings that went on, and he never said much about it. I guess not much could be done. But, I mean, it's just when you look back, you just say, why didn't leadership say, I don't care what is going on, I don't care what people in Alabama or Georgia feel, we have to take action on this. But they never did.
Yeah,
and even now, they're not really dealing with racial discrimination adequately, no matter how many laws we have. You know, it's that's why in many ways...
Well, that's because leadership is, you know, gutless. And the police departments have been, you know, pretty well corrupted. A lot of the major, any major metropolitan police force has got the corruption of white supremacy in it. And
history has had that.
Yeah, it's just the way it is. Now, I'm not saying
the FDR's time, I'm just, even in FDR's time or others, you know, yeah.
Yeah, now, but you got your heroes and your sheroes, you know, the people who do stand up and make themselves a rallying point for hope in this unkindness. You have, we historically always have, and we still have today. There are plenty of people out there, and I would mention to you, every person who has marched in the streets through COVID for Black Lives Matter has my absolute devotion, my absolute devotion of gratitude. You know, these
I marched here in Annapolis on the Black Lives Matter.
Right.
You know, they were black and white, so there was actually Masonic lodges that got together, you know, the state of Maryland here, and we all met as Freemasons, brothers of, you know, Masonry, and we marched, you know, and chanted all the way down to the town docks, which is the old historical docks. Matter of fact, a little bit of side note here, the historical docks downtown, and Gwen, I know you were, what was that bar you knew there on Main Street? It wasn't Dockside, it was O'Brien's.
O'Brien's, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, you go down that street and the docks there at the end of the water, at the end of that street. There's a statue, a bronze statue of Alex. You got who wrote Roots?
Alex Haley.
Alex Haley. A statue of Alex Haley and small children, black and white small children, all bronze statues down there by that inner dock, because it was in Annapolis that Kunta Kinte landed on the shores and was sold in slavery.
Yeah.
At that spot on those docks in Annapolis.
There are
so
bright moments.
Huh?
There are bright moments. There, and like I said, we do have worthy heroes and hopeful icons out there. But
just not enough of them.
Well, the point is, it's up to us. Each of us individually has to become that for ourselves and for our community. And until that consciousness sets in.
The thing is, you know, if you don't speak out, then you become part of the problem.
You're right.
And yes, you're going to take a chance of being targeted when you speak out, even though it's the truth. You know, there'll be those who will target you. But I am fighting environmental battles with he was a tenacious Irish bastard, Jim Dolan. Very good friend. He was my best man when I married Carol. His father was Democratic chairman of Newcastle County, Delaware. There's only three counties in Delaware. And he was Democratic chairman, which is the Wilmington area, the more populous area. And he was the one that taught me how to fight political battles, but because it's through environmental consciousness and stuff, of stating what we knew was blatantly obvious and stuff, and those in government's desire of inaction for us. It was just not going to be tolerated. You know, they were even enabling some of those polluters. And people were dying of being polluted, you know, of being poisoned.
Yeah.
He was the one who taught me how to do it, so.
There's there's always somewhere, there's always light and there's always hope. It's just that right now, I mean, we all put our faith in getting that son of a bitch out of the White House that's down here now in our neighborhood, Ron's and mine.
Yes, right. And he was just in North Carolina last night and talked about the, quote, crime of the century.
Yeah.
What, the crime of the century? What was that? I understand.
I think the crime was that he, quote, won, end quote, in 2016 with Russian involvement.
Right.
Yeah.
Even the Republican Intelligence Committee, the Senate, which was Republican-controlled Intelligence Committee, did review of it, and their statement was, it was like in September, October time frame of last year, said, it is obvious and it is true that Donald Trump and his administration committed treasonous acts with the Russians during that 2016 election. They stated it. But
yeah.
When it came time to find him guilty of it...
We keep putting our faith into, you know, oh, they're not corrupt. They're going to get it done. And, you know, they're the good guys. So we put our faith into Mueller. Well, what a big crapshoot that was, eh, boys?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and frankly, I thought Mueller backpedaled everything.
Yes,
really.
He did. Yes,
and,
he did.
And it was a screw over on the American people. You know, it's like, all I can think is we got to get these old fuckers out of D.C. And I'm not just talking men, I'm talking women too. But I will tell you, one woman who has stuck by and is working with what she can to get things done has been Pelosi. And a lot of people I know will say, you know, what, are you nuts, Gwen? She's part of the machine. Well, she is. But she's one of the cogs that's actually working.
So, right now, my big hero is Stacey Adams.
Yeah.
You know, you give that lady everything
Abrams.
She can to... Huh?
Abrams.
Sorry. Yeah, I meant Abrams. Yeah, Stacey Abrams, right?
Yeah.
You know, now she's got some higher hurdles to try to cross over and get people motivated. The only way you're going to get these stifling... voting laws eliminated is to basically get to the polls, motivate people, come out in quantities, and basically just overwhelm the voting booths. I don't care if you have to take a day's vacation, but get people out there and get it voted, because the only way you're going to get that change now is to get those bastards out of there and then repeal all those restrictive laws and the right to vote. The Republican chairman, I think it was, in Texas, Professor Ron, correct me here, basically he said that had they not stifled and limited the amount of mail-out ballots in Texas so they wouldn't be counted, he said, or Texas would have gone blue.
I think it is possible, yeah. And I think it still will eventually.
Yeah, but still, I mean, we're talking about this last election. By stifling and outlawing the amount of mail-out ballots to be filled out and sent back in was what kept Texas Republicans and the Texas state of Texas red.
Yeah, well, I think Texas eventually will go that way, but they have, their government is just unbelievable. It really is, you know. The governor is such a nightmare. He really is.
And the abortion laws that are going through their legislators right now. There's a high school valedictorian. She submitted,
pretty awful.
Okay,
we've
here's
got,
the email valedictorian.
Okay, we have 1 moment until we go off the air, so...
it was a good hour. We had a lot of discussion of a lot of issues. Thanks so much, Gwen.
You're welcome. And people can find you where, Ron?
Okay, theprogressiveprofessor.com, on History News Network under my name, Ronald L. Fineman, on Facebook and on Twitter. Twitter is under POLITHIST.
Okay, and Wayne, thank you for being
here. Yes, always a pleasure.
Where can they find you? Hurry.
I was going to say, Minds and Times of F. Wayne Johnson. Just type that into a Google search, you'll find it. Brandon,
okay.
It's all you.
Okay, thank you, Jim.
Thanks so much, everyone.
We will be back next Sunday at 6 p.m. Thank you for tuning in. This has been the Sunday Show on Here Be Monsters Radio. Thank you. Good night, gentlemen.
Good night.